This is the Amp Hour Podcast, recorded November 28th, 2011. Episode 71, Luciferous LED Lucubrator.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gammel from Chris Gammel's Analog Life.
And I'm John Edmund from Cree.
Whoa!
Well, welcome, John.
Hey, John.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on our humble show here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And so, where are you located, John? Where's Cree out of?
Our headquarters is in Durham, North Carolina.
Ah, so slightly warmer than
Cleveland. Is that a North Carolina accent I hear?
No.
No?
It's not.
Where do you hail from?
Is yours a North Carolina accent?
It's Australian.
I hail from Western New York.
Ah.
Western New York? Really?
Yeah, western part of the state. Yeah, near Rochester.
Oh, okay. I'm from Buffalo.
Is there a different accent between East and West New York?
There's a big difference.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So me and John are both upstaters, right?
That's right. We're upstate New Yorkers.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm from a part with a really nasally A, too. I'm from Amherst.
I know, right? Amherst,
New York. Yeah.
Well, then you should have said, "Are you from near Rochester?" Because I've had people say that to me.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
They can pick out that little nuance in the.
They can pick it out.
It's
yeah.
been a while. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So, what's your position at Cree?
I'm the director of Advanced Optoelectronics Technology. A big long title.
Dang.
Wow. And a co-founder, is that correct?
I am a co-founder, yep.
Co-founder. We have a co-founder of Cree.
We have
on
a co-founder of a huge company that makes a lot of cool stuff on our show. This is pretty great, I got to say. I'm very excited.
Yeah.
I'm very excited.
I agree with Chris. We have some really cool stuff here. That's why I keep doing it. I love it.
That's great. So, you're in charge on like a technical level, or I mean managerial. What is it these days? I mean, are you? I think Ginny, your social media person who's helping us out, said you're still at the bench a lot of times. Tell us about that.
I am still at the bench. I was soldering leads on a part today. So yes, I have a group of guys that work under me, and our focus is to work on the next generation LED chip or component or. Light bulb or whatever.
Wow.
Would most of that be like silicon research or manufacturing process research? I would assume it would be.
Well, you said silicon, so we don't work on silicon. Yep. We work on...
I stand humbly corrected. My knowledge of semiconductor manufacturing is nigh on zip. Whereas Chris has actually worked at a manufacturing.
Hey Dave, it would have been a lot worse if you said silicone. Believe me,
silicone. Yeah,
I've heard that several times.
Well, we would have just signed off the show right then. We would have just said,
"Oh,
we're done."
Manufacturing technology here in. You know, the backwater that is Australia, you know. We've got one fab here which specializes in silicon on sapphire.
Okay.
But that's the only lab that we have left here, and we've only ever had one or maybe two. So, yeah. Unlike the US, where there are a dime a dozen.
Yeah.
Dime a dozen,
but,
please.
I'll answer your question because I think I know
what
you're asking. So, we're working on the chip side, so that might be. Things that are in the chip fab, for example, new chip designs, different looking chips. All our chips are based on silicon carbide, however. So we either leave the silicon carbide on or remove the silicon carbide and put it on another type of substrate. And that's, I'm talking about the epi layer. So the light emitting layer is all done on silicon carbide, which makes us different than pretty much every LED manufacturer in the world.
And why is that? Why are you using silicon carbide and nobody else is? Do you guys have it locked up in patents or what?
That's part of it, but the other part of it is we vertically integrated. We started a company based on silicon carbide LEDs and silicon carbide electronics. So that was our core difference, right? That was our ace in a hole. And so no one else was able to do silicon carbide.
So, and that's what gives you the efficiency advantage in terms of efficacy, lumens per watt, and that sort of stuff?
We believe that.
Right.
We still have the brightest parts, the highest lumens per watt, and compared to anybody on Sapphire right now. So we continue to push the envelope, and they're continuing to push the envelope, and we keep staying ahead 5 to 10% along the way.
Excellent. So a silicon carbide wafer, right? So you said that's you use the epi layer at the top? I was under the assumption that the entire boule was, or the entire wafer was silicon carbide. Is that incorrect?
The wafer is silicon carbide, but we grow a gallium nitride layer on top.
Ah, okay.
The active light emitting region is indium gallium nitride quantum wells.
Holy moly.
Zoom straight over my head.
Yeah, Dave, we're out of our element here, buddy.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry.
Back to resistors.
Resistors.
I need an op amp.
So, you know, everybody grows in-GaN quantum wells on Sapphire, but we do it on silicon carbide.
Okay. Right.
That's how we started the company, and that's what we continue to do.
And so can you tell, so Sapphire then is different than silicon carbide, correct?
That is correct. It's a different material. Sapphire is aluminum oxide. And aluminum oxide has a different coefficient of thermal expansion. It's got different properties that lattice mismatch is another thing. It's not quite as closely matched to the nitrides as silicon carbide is. So we felt right off the bat that silicon carbide was going to be a better material.
Yeah. Wow. I had heard that a lot of the silicon wafers you guys, or silicon carbide wafers you guys make, are actually one of the only sources in the world. Is that right? Of the actual raw wafer?
We're the source. I would say we're the best source of the wafer. There's more companies coming out with silicon carbide now for high power electronics.
Okay.
So, but we're still biggest.
So, okay. Do you manufacture the wafers in your own fab? Do you do everything, like bring in raw materials and?
Yep.
Yeah, you do everything. Yep. Have you always done that from day one?
Yes, we are vertically integrated from basically raw material powders, gases,
right,
to finished light fixtures that you can buy in Home Depot. So that's pretty vertically integrated.
Sand in one end and cool stuff out the other end.
Yeah. You got it.
That's
awesome. Take a bucket of sand from the beach.
Yeah, you're pretty accurate because it's really sand and coal. Really, it's coal, charcoal and sand.
Yep.
Man.
I know. It's brilliant. All done in the one factory. It's it's almost cartoonish. You know, I'm picturing like a cartoon, material.
Yeah.
You know, they
just dump it in
one end and magic comes out the other end.
That's the idea.
Oh, that's great.
Now, I didn't realize that gallium nitride was a critical part of the process, too. I always thought that the LEDs you guys were making were mostly silicon carbide as a base, and then you did like the usual dopants and growths on top of that. I didn't know it was necessarily a gallium nitride growth. Is that a bad assumption on my part?
When we started Cree, our first LEDs were all silicon carbide. You're 100% right. So from 1988 to 1995, so for 7 years, we made silicon carbide on silicon carbide based LEDs. So that we were the only ones that had blue LEDs out. Then we started working on nitrides. And nitrides are much more efficient, right? They can be, but there was problems in making those materials. So for the first 7 years, it was all silicon carbide. And since then, it's been nitrides on silicon carbide.
So there's only been one major technology leap there?
That's a huge technology leap.
Right. Oh, yeah, but yeah.
A whole new material, whatever.
So do you see anything in the future, any major leaps like that in the future in terms of you know, the actual process technology, or is it more, I think we've got it, we'll just tweak these because we're getting near the tweak the current processes because we're getting very near to the what we can achieve or something like that?
I'd say the latter is true. I mean, there's not too many. There was a lot of work on zinc selenide, which is another direct band gap material, and it just floundered because of degradation. This material is very rock solid, and we're approaching efficiencies now of 75 to 80%. So you're not going to get a lot more out. And I just don't think there's any other materials that are going to get close to that.
Wow.
Interesting. So basically just your job now is sort of extracting, you know, an extra, our goal this year is to extract a couple of extra percent out of this baby and keep leading the market.
Yeah,
is that
my slogan
sort
with
of
my,
stuff you're working on?
Yeah, my slogan with my team is no photon left behind.
Oh, brilliant. Are there signs around the company with that?
No.
T-shirts?
Oh, yeah.
T-shirts? We should get t-shirts.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think
Jenny,
I think
we need
tell,
to work on that.
Yeah, yep. Jenny should do
Jenny's
that.
Jenny's shaking her head. Yeah.
No, Send us a couple of t-shirts too, please.
Yeah, okay, I'd take
one. Yes, please. We'll take a t-shirt.
So can you go back to those early days? Because I imagine, you know, we were talking about this factory, you dump sand in, and then you eventually get light bulbs out. But how
light
do you start?
Bulbs?
Well, Lightbeam said vertically integrated. They're actually making modules,
this isn't
right?
Edison. This isn't the Edison era.
This is
LED
this
bulbs?
Is exactly what you just – that's true, yes.
Okay. Well, regardless, when you're dumping the sand in, you're actually making the silicon carbide the first time. I mean, I've seen videos of them actually drawing – at least silicon boules out. We were talking with Jerry Ellsworth on here a while back on, about that process and stuff. But how do you – I mean, you don't just like go down to your store and buy, you know, a foundry that can do that. Like how do you – do you just start out with really tiny ones and then tiny wafers?
Well,
or how do you
– we started out with 1 centimeter wafers.
Oh,
so that's pretty, man. That's pretty
yep.
small.
Yeah.
So you can imagine that's – that's really small, but you can't. The silicon carbide doesn't melt, so you can't pull it from a liquid like you can with silicon or sapphire or some of those other materials. So it's very difficult to grow, so it's very different.
But that's all you need to start out with, right? Is like a 1 centimeter wide wafer, because like that's all you need for experimentation.
Oh, that's how.
Right? Is there any advantage to going to larger apart from the yield in actually volume manufacturing?
Oh, sure.
Is there any...
Well, you say yield, but it really comes down to cost.
Cost, yes.
That's right. And yeah, you know, you could. I did my PhD on 1 centimeter wafers that we grew in a lab. So, no, you can do a lot of R&D on that. But to get to a real manufacturing process, you need, you know, 4-inch, 6-inch.
Oh, of course. You'd need, yep, large ones. So is that how the company started? It was based on your PhD research and other people's, and you got together. How did it? Please tell us a story.
Yeah, so we had a group of students at NC State University here in Raleigh, North Carolina, and we were all working on silicon carbide. It was an Office of Naval Research Office of Naval Research program, and we basically were able to create enough technology that a couple brothers that were in the program that had graduated, Eric and Neil Hunter, they approached myself and another guy, John Palmer, another guy, Calvin Carter, and one other fellow, Tommy Coleman, and said, hey, let's start a company. And that's really how it started.
Right. How does it work? Because that was government funded, but I assume being naval research funding, that would be government dollars.
It was government
dollars. How do you... Sorry?
It was definitely government dollars.
Right. So how do you then take that technology and then what are the legal aspects of taking that technology and just forming your own company? Because I assume all that technology would be public domain because it was government funded.
That's right. So what you do is you basically – the first thing we did is we wrote 10 patents on the technology. So all the technology right. that we invented, we wrote the patents, and then we basically asked for an exclusive license from NC State. So we came out, we wrote the patents, we went to NC State and said, can now, after we just wrote these, can we have an exclusive license? We'll give you stock in a company. And right. they said, okay, we got to go back to the government and ask them. And the government said, yeah, we don't care about it. It's just you guys you guys aren't going to amount to anything. So
that'll never work.
So no, it'll never work. So we got exclusive license to the technology.
Fantastic!
Wow.
And they didn't think the stock was going to be worth anything.
Yeah,
but it was.
I mean, that's a zero.
So
yeah.
they still own stock. Penn State still owns stock in the
NC State. North
oh, sorry, NC State.
No, Penn State's got some problems right now, so let's not talk about them.
Yeah, different issues. Yeah,
right. So.
They have some issues.
Yeah. So do they still have ownership in the company though? Does NC State still?
I think that they sold all their stock. I don't know for sure though. You'd have to ask them.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Right.
Okay. But they helped you get started in some capacity because they gave you rights to the patents that you worked on.
That's right.
Which
it's interesting,
and that kind of thing happens now too. There's technology transfer offices. at a lot of schools. I know Michigan has one, MIT has one, Stanford has one, because they're great sources of, you know, new work. You know, that's how that transfer happens is a big deal, and a lot of schools are concentrating on it more now. I don't know if they had an office back then.
Now they are, because back then it was just like they didn't have that. They were like, I don't know what to do with this thing. Now, MIT had it, but places like NC State, there just wasn't a lot of companies that came out of there. SAS was one of them. You know, SAS software came out of NC State. So it was, you know, there was a precedence, but very few, they just didn't know what to do with it. So it worked out good.
Yeah, but that definitely works out good. Yeah. So tell me about I'm still stuck on this silicon carbide generation, or how you first made it, right? I looked up silicon carbide for the show, and I researched a little bit before then even, and I was reading about moissanite too. And so was ever the inclination to be like, you know what, I'm just going to go grow some diamonds in the lab. Is that ever crossed the mind, or
growing diamonds?
Well, I mean, moissanite is fake diamonds, right? I mean, or close to diamonds, right?
I would say it's better than diamond, but that's besides the point.
you have to say that, right?
Of course I have to. We're not working on diamonds, but silicon carbide, turns out, has a property called birefringence, which means it has a different refractive index in different directions. So it basically has a better sparkle than diamond. But that was not why we started doing it.
Well, of course not, yeah.
That was not a dream.
Right. Okay, right. Cool.
So how did what capital funding did you need, and how did you get the capital funding to start up Cree?
It was basically talking to friends and family, going to a bar and sit there, and someone writes you a check for $5,000, and it was some other folks. It was just all family and friends, basically.
Right, so there was no venture capital?
Zero.
Zero.
That's amazing.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. We came close a few times, but we didn't do
it. The draw is there, right? It's like, oh, we could not eat ramen tonight, right?
That's true.
Yeah. Man. So,
and I bet they're glad they did, if they held on to their stock when it... did it float? When did Cree float? Was it a huge success? I don't know the history.
Well, we went public.
How many years after?
We went public, I think it was 93 or 94, Jenny.
Right, so that's like 5 years after
you
started?
Yeah, we started in 87, so it was like 7 years, something like that.
Okay. So that's a fair long time. That's a fairly long time to wait to get your return on your investment, your $5,000 you put in there, I guess.
Yeah, and if the guys held on, I mean, they became millionaires because the price was like very, very, very low.
Yeah,
relative to what it went to. So,
Yeah, I saw your interview with Ginny and about, you know, your early days and working day in and day out. Could you tell us more about just like how that kind of ramped up then? Because going from that $5,000, borrowed $5,000, up to, you know, having large scale fabs is a big stretch. So I'm sure there's some good stories in the middle there too.
Well, like I said, like you said, we worked day and night. I mean, it was like come in and see each other at breakfast time, and then go to lunch together, then go to dinner together, and then go home at 10 o'clock and see each other again for breakfast. And not 6 days a week, 7 days a week.
Wow.
So it was – we had to build – you got to remember, we built every piece of equipment we had. We didn't – there was nothing
That's
out there
awesome.
You talked about.
I know.
We built everything. We built our epi reactors because there wasn't anything out there. We built our crystal growers. We had to invent everything.
That is awesome.
That is fantastic.
Wow.
There was nothing out there commercial.
Wow. So where did you get the boot? Did you continue to bootstrap it? Like, did you sell early parts and get some revenue? Where did the money continue to come from over those years before you actually, you know, really sold commercial volumes and stuff like that?
As far as before we went public,
when did revenue start flowing?
Like $11 million. Revenue started flowing in probably 1990. We did that was the first deal we did with Sumitomo in Japan as a distributor for us, and they're still our distributor today in Japan. I think we were like 2 weeks from running out of money, and we signed that deal.
Oh, wow.
it was, I think, a $2 million deal, and they got exclusive distributorship to our LEDs in Japan.
How many LEDs were you churning out in those early days?
Oh, I mean, probably, you know, a couple thousand a month. It was like nothing.
A month, right.
It was nothing.
Wow. But they were a lot higher priced back. I remember I saw also in that interview with Ginny about the blue LEDs and how that was such a different thing when that came out. That, I mean, I'm sure that they got some pretty decent dough for them.
They did. I mean, Osram was there. Siemens was a company that had them out there for $75 a piece, and you could barely see them lit up.
$75 for a blue LED.
In 1987.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So we
and
came.
That's $987.
Yeah. If so, we came out with
ours. What's
that
worth today?
That would be probably $150, $200 or something.
Yeah, at least.
Double that at least.
And it was,
yeah.
and it barely lit up. It was terrible. Right. So we came out with ours. We were under a dollar. We came out with 99 cents.
Oh wow!
Wow! Instantly. So you instantly slashed it two orders of magnitude almost.
That's right.
Wow.
So that, awesome. that
helps
huge.
Sell.
Yeah, that, yeah.
And that's why I think Sumitomo bought on, because they said, hey, Cree can do it for a lot less than everybody else. And we were about four or five times brighter than Siemens was at the time.
Was there a temptation to sell it for $10 instead of $1 just because you could? Because that's what the market was used to paying $70. Well, you know, hey, $10 would be a revolution.
They didn't sell. They sold them only for like medical applications for blood gas analysis or some crazy thing. We were going into indicators. We were going into actual indicators for electronics at that time.
Yep.
Oh, so you're almost playing against the red and the yellows, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but for high end stuff.
Okay.
And then our first big
like blue.
Yeah, I love it. But the first big application was the dashboard of Volkswagen automobiles. That was the big one. That's where we really turned the corner.
Oh, is that
so
when...
you're responsible for the horrible trend in blue dashboards?
Yes.
So was that when they redid the Beetle, like with the trendy Beetle? And
yes.
Was that the all that, was that all the era the, of that?
That's it. Yeah, it was mid-90s.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. And then Jetta was real big, too, and Jetta had that nice blue dashboard. Yeah. I remember that, too.
What was wrong with just using a regular light bulb with a blue filter?
Well, you tell me.
What was the...
The
bulbs blow, but they're still using bulbs these days. It's crazy. I can't believe it.
I guess they still do some, but I don't think much. Yeah. Most everything is LED dashboard.
Yeah.
But the blue was... I think the... the CEO of Osram and Volkswagen got together. The two CEOs got together, and they looked at it, and they said, this is just beautiful.
Right. It was just a more beautiful, in quote marks, color than a crusty light bulb with a blue filter on the front.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Exactly.
Right.
Cellophane.
And they said, we want to do this. Okay. And so that was our first big
That's awesome.
One. Yeah, cellophane doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, like those stage lights where they do the cellophane covers. Oh, yeah. Like 1,000 watts.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
So what about? I mean, so those first sales. I mean, that's a big deal. And then, what about the ramp up? Then, I mean, you started. Was it actually after the going public that it was a bigger ramp up? Because, I'm guessing you probably can't sell a couple thousand a month
definitely...
to get into cars.
No. But even before then, we were selling silicon carbide LEDs, not nitride based, but silicon carbide on silicon carbide. We were selling millions of them.
Oh, okay.
A quarter. So they were making display boards and they were doing indicators, and there's a lot of applications. But then once the Volkswagen hit, that just, like I said, that just took us to the next level, and we were doing several million a month above that. So it just, that was the big ramp right after that.
Wow. And so, where do you manufacture all of your LEDs these days?
Every wafer is made here. Every epi layer is grown here in Durham.
USA.
All our wafer fab is here in Durham.
USA.
USA,
and is that,
yes.
Is that a deliberate choice by the company? Have you looked at the financials and gone, oh, it might be cheaper to offshore it?
That's a good question.
But we'll keep it here and be patriotic.
There's a big there's a big part of our operation that's in China because they're, frankly, they're our biggest customer. So you have to be one of our biggest customers.
Yeah.
So we bought Cotco, which is Chinese Optical Technical Company, whatever it stood for. They were the biggest LED manufacturer in China.
So you bought the biggest LED manufacturer. Ah, who were they?
we'll take them over.
Yeah.
but that was three or four years ago. Mm-hmm. 3 or 4 years ago. So it's – or maybe 5 years ago. I don't know what it's been. But by being there – we have we don't do any of our I'll call critical technology. All of that's kept here,
which is the wafer type stuff.
Which is the wafer part. Yeah. That's right. So they take the wafer and they cut it up and they encapsulate it, package it, whatever you want to call it, and they go into LEDs for display boards like New York City. They go into everything after that.
Yeah.
So they do a lot of great work over there, and we've got 2,000 people working over there.
Wow.
Fantastic. How many people total in the entire Cree organization, the monolithic organization?
I think we just about 6,000.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic.
What about some of the packaging technology? So, I mean, you talked about packaging done in China, but it seems like that's a pretty critical part to most LEDs because drawing the heat away from the dye and trying
to get the heat out,
Yeah.
Right, but okay. So doing that is extremely important, but it's all the pilot lines are here. So we develop all the packaging technology here in Durham, and then we send. Well, actually, I shouldn't say all of it. Some is done there. We have a good R&D group there as well. Mm-hmm. So we do some of it there. Most of it's done here, and then we transfer it over.
Okay. So what is in the future for that kind of thing? I mean, is it actually going to get into fancier package types for the actual LED packaging? Is it going to be external to that with better heat sinks on, you know, in a bulb configuration? Is it going to be – or just lower power draw on the actual dye, the silicon carbide dye?
I think it's going to be all those. I mean, right now, the standard packages are small. They're 3.5 by 3.5 millimeters or 5 by 5 millimeters or 10 by 10 millimeters. Will they get to be – you know, huge? I don't think they're going to get much more. I think some of the biggest arrays now are on maybe 30 or 40 millimeter copper core boards, basic fine board technology.
Okay.
Right.
So, yeah, but then, like you said, everything goes, you got to have a heat sink that gets it to the outside world and then in the light bulb application. So all three things are going to evolve.
Are there any plans for Cree to branch out into manufacturing full bulb replacements, as in the whole package, or do you guys just want to stick with the LED itself?
So right now we actually sell bulb replacements.
You do? Okay.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Oh, we sell there you go.
Par 38s, par 30s, 6-inch can replacements.
Oh, you do.
We sell. Like I said,
Dave's going shopping.
We go from raw material to go into Home Depot. Home Depot. I don't know if you do. You have Home Depot in Australia?
No, we don't. I heard it's big in the US, though. Yeah,
it's a bit. It's just a big, you know, home
hardware
department store,
type
basically.
Store with
hardware big box. Yep. Yeah.
And they've got lots of lighting in there. There's a lot of LED lighting, and we're in there. In on their shelves.
Hmm. All right, I'm going to ask the big question. When do you see the critical mass happening where LEDs will take over from CFLs?
Completely take over, or
the tipping point where it's you know, it just becomes cost effective and the longevity is better and yada yada yada.
Right. So today you can get, I think, the cheapest bulbs out there, and they're not very good and they're not Cree's, but you can pay about 3 cents per lumen. So That's not really good, because if you have to have a 1,000 lumens, let's say they're 430 lumens for about $10.
Right.
So that's the best I've seen. I think that's about 3 cents. So if you could get down by an order of magnitude, which I think is possible, believe it or not, you could get to you know, a dollar bulb for 430, then I think you're there. Because CFLs are giving them away. I mean, they're giving them away. So it's hard to compete with someone, giving bulbs away. And that's what the power companies are doing.
Mm. Oh, okay. So you're saying it's almost subsidized at that point.
It is subsidized.
Yeah, okay.
So, how many years away? You're the best guy in the industry to guess this. Everyone wants to know.
I would say that you'll be able to buy a sub $5 bulb in the next 2 years. That's about a 500 lumen bulb.
Well, Dave's setting you up for he's trying to say he wants to be able to point at something in 2 years and be like, "Aha, John said it wrong." he won't say that out loud, but that's what he's going for.
I think I'll be right. It might be lower than that, but I think I'll be right.
Yeah. I think you'll probably be right too.
A dollar
bulb, it's probably going to be a while, probably 5 years.
Huh.
So where does I'm jumping in here, Chris. Okay, I got in first, I think.
All right.
where do you what is your best Cree LED? What's the best efficiency on or efficacy on your Cree LEDs now compared to CFLs and fluoro tubes in general?
Okay, so
is it on par, better?
Are you talking about R&D or are you talking about...
No, I'm talking about ones you can buy. I'm talking about commercial.
Ones you can buy right now, you can buy, I think our highest bin's about 170 lumens per watt.
Yep.
So that's about 2x the best CFLs you're going to get.
Right. What about the larger fluoro tubes as opposed to CFLs? Like the strip,
they're 100 lumens per watt.
Okay. Right. So you guys are almost doing 1.8 times that.
And that light is a tube, so light goes up. They don't count. You're going to have losses, right, because they have reflectors.
You've got to have reflectors, yep.
Right. LEDs are more directional, so you don't have – you can have a lot less loss in the system.
Hmm. Mm. I've got a question that I noticed the market years ago went from specking LEDs in candelas, and it moved to lumens per watt. Can you tell us the history of why that happened or how that happened?
Well, I think because we went from blue and green and red, right, to white. As soon as you go to white, people want to know how many lumens it is because that's what's on your light bulb.
Yep.
Box.
And how do you measure that? You measure that with a sphere, don't you? It's measured with a big sphere.
Integrating sphere. That's correct.
And integrating sphere. How do they work?
It's basically it's a big ball. You put your light bulb inside of it, and the inside has basically 100% reflectivity.
Right.
So it's just a big – it's a white painting and white coating, and then that gets detected in a radiometric system, and it measures the amount of lumens. It's straightforward. They've been doing it forever.
How much fudgery – fudge. I don't know if that's a word. Is that a word? How much fudging is there in the industry with these figures?
That's what you're looking for, right, Dave?
A lot of them are bullshit. I mean, you buy these cheap ones on eBay, and they're just absolute bullshit.
Yeah, you're right. They're going to – I guess they have a lighting fax now on most of the new bulbs to be – Energy Star and lighting fax. Lighting fax.
Oh, okay. Is this a U.S. government thing, is it?
Yes.
Right.
And it requires the lumen number, the color rendering index, which is the light quality, the power input. Mm-hmm. So basically you can get lumens and lumens per watt and color, warm white. It has a color temperature on there, warm white, cool white.
Yeah.
And so you got
to. Is there still a way to cheat that system, though? Fudge your numbers a little bit here and there?
I don't think so. I think they're pretty accurate now.
Right.
If it has a lighting fax on it, and if you look for. If it says Energy Star, then it definitely. And our bulbs do, then you definitely. There's no fudging there.
Right. Got it.
And so there's a third party that does that kind of evaluation then? Is that the idea?
That's correct.
Okay, so it's not an in-house number.
Well, we have an in-house.
Oh, of course,
system.
You test them in-house, so you know what you're going to get.
Right, yep. Everything is sent out and qualified,
certified independently.
Yep, that's correct. Yep.
So,
excellent.
If I can go back to the LED bulb takeover that Dave was asking about,
yep.
I mean, are you guys scaled up to actually take that on? I mean, are we going to always be buying Cree bulbs, or is there actually going to is there any way you guys could even do that in terms of sheer numbers?
Well, the biggest that's impossible. I mean, you got the biggest lighting manufacturers just throwing all their money at LEDs. That's Osram. Yeah. That's Philips. That's GE. And
One's up the street from me, actually.
Which one? Oh, GE.
Yeah, GE in East Cleveland. Yeah.
So all the, I mean, all those companies are also, you know, they're good customers of Cree's. So, you're going to have a bunch of different bulb companies, and the big ones are going to be the biggest. Now, we hope to be right there as far as the best quality. We're always going to innovate and try the best light bulb out there.
Yeah.
Who's your biggest competitor at the moment?
The raw dyes, right?
In terms of the raw, lumens per watt.
Raw. Okay, so on a raw chip side, which is really blue, just a blue pump, I would still say Nichia is the closest to us as anybody.
Right.
And then after that, it's basically Toyota Gasai out of Japan, and then it just moves down to Taiwan Inc., basically.
But you think you're back in the best horse with the silicon carbide, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. There you go.
So the blue LED, though, that I'd like to ask about the makeup of white LED. I mean, that is mostly a blue LED. Is that correct?
That's most applications use a blue LED pump, and they put a phosphor on top of it. And that phosphor glows either yellow or yellow and red if you want warm white. So you have the blue plus the yellow or green and red, and you get the full color spectrum.
Man.
That's why it was easy for you guys to transition from the blue LED technology into the white stuff, which you're mostly known for these days.
That's correct. But the other thing we did was our lighting systems, almost all our lighting system have what's called true white technology, which has a yellow LED, basically a blue with a yellow pump, and then we add a red LED to it. So it's got two different types of LEDs. It's got a blue and a red and a phosphor, and that gives it very, very rich, very, very rich color. The color rendering or color quality, it looks like that of an incandescent.
See, that's kind of tough for me as a consumer. You know, as an electronics person who has put white LEDs into designs and everything, I got to say, I'm like, it's just a light bulb. I know there's a lot of nuance to it, but that's what I think of, right? I mean, I'm still stuck in incandescent days. Right. I mean, that's a horrible thing, but it's just a reality.
The reason that our bulbs have been so successful is when they install them, people don't know it's LED. That's the key.
Yeah.
If you walk in someplace and you can't tell it's an LED, then if it looks like an incandescent or standard lighting, you've just won it. Your payback is less than 2 years, and your energy costs went down by 80%. That's where you win.
See, now that's awesome.
That's where you win.
Yeah. That's great, too. That's saving the world right there,
I'm building a new lab at the moment, and I want to fit it out with LED lights, but it's still not even order of magnitude close to being cost-effective compared to fluorescent strip bulbs. I mean, I did the math, basic math, and the payback period at the moment was 15 years or something. It was crazy.
So how do you think we're selling? How would you answer to the question? Why are is our lighting business growing fast as anything here at Cree? So if it's not cost effective, why is Los Angeles putting in 150,000 streetlights right now with Cree LEDs in them?
Oh, no, because they...
LA has high taxes?
But I'm talking about, stuff that I can buy for my office. There doesn't appear to be. There are tons of applications out there where LEDs, every street, traffic light in Australia has been changed to LED. That was 5 years ago or something.
Right.
There was a huge, big difference. But I don't know. Perhaps I've done my math wrong, haven't done enough research. But just for the sheer fitting out my lab at the moment, the payback, was only 2 years, I'd certainly do it.
Are the lights on 24/7?
No. No, they'd only be on, 7-8 hours a day or something. So
okay.
Yeah, Dave doesn't work that much, so.
No.
So your payback, it's not 20 years. Jenny, what do you think that would be? Just off the top of your head, 6 years, 5 years, something like that? Yeah. I don't know where you're getting.
Well, it was basically the cost of actually buying these strip replacement LED that fitted in the existing sockets. You know, that's where you're paying your high price, I think.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, if I totally ripped out all of the ceiling lights and then installed, you know, the cheapest fitting I could get with the cheapest replacement, then I could probably do it.
And if you're doing new construction, you need to go on our website, and we have a troffer series that will fit into all those applications. But it's not replacing the bulb. It's putting the whole either 2x2 or 2x4 troffer up in that space.
Yeah, that's the thing. I was pricing that based on the current available price for the just, you know, you flip in that, you know, you take out the old bulb, you put in the new strip fluoro bulb, the, you know, the 4-foot long one.
Yeah,
kind of thing, and yeah, don't seem to be there yet.
No, I agree with you.
And there's lots of nasty ones on the market that are just horrible. They're using this 5mm, you know, one hung low brand Chinese, you know, the cheapest 5mm LEDs they can get, and the design of them is terrible, and they don't meet safety standards, and they burn out, and they're
So what's the name of that company again? One hung low, you said?
One hung low.
Okay, I'll look that up. Make sure you don't get those.
I mean, John, do you see it being, I mean, do you see Cree over the long term being that vertically integrated, though? I mean, where you guys are actually selling fixtures and light bulbs and everything? Because I would think over the long term, it's not going to be realistic that, you know, eventually you're going to have to just sell LEDs, because that's what I would think. Because it's,
it's the opposite. Someday we won't be selling LEDs. We'll be selling.
Really?
Well, look, again, if you go to our website, we sell LED troffers, we sell LED bulbs, that's the fastest growing part of our business is the LED lighting. We just bought a company up in Racine, Wisconsin called Rude Lighting, and it's all street lighting. And we have 800 people up there that all made 100% in the USA, and we're doing LA, we're doing street lights all over the country. So I would hope someday we would just be making everything for internal use. That would be, I mean, maybe it's 5 years from now. I don't know, 10 years from now. I don't know.
So you don't see the fab as a long-term model? I mean, is that kind of the, I mean, not from the business side, but just from you as being in the business, you think it's the fun stuff on the application side more than the development of the bits side? Not the bits, but the.
No. There will still be development. There's no question about it. We're going to continue to make better. And it's the bottom line is you got to decrease the cost of the chip. So your dollars per lumen has got to go way, way, way down into the dirt.
Yeah.
Like 0.002 maybe. So 0.2, 0.1 per lumen. Mm-hmm. If you can get to that point, which I think we can in the next couple of years. And then on top of that, you increase the lumens per watt as high as you can. So you can imagine if you could have $3 in LEDs in a 1,000-watt bulb, you could make a bulb for $5 or $6 that's 1,000 lumens. And it's not that far away. It's not that far away.
So just to give a perspective on that, too, that 0.001 per lumen, is that roughly what an incandescent is? I mean, I kind of take incandescent as like the bottom of the barrel.
No, you know, I think incandescents are a lot lower than that.
Oh, okay.
Wait a minute. Okay, so let's say you get a 4-pack of bulbs.
Okay.
100-watt bulb, which is going to be pretty soon, but they claim they're 1,500 lumens, right? So let's say you pay a buck for that 4-pack. That's 0.25. That's 25 cents divided by 1,500. That is 0.000. That's $2. So it's 0.002 per lumen.
Wow. Okay.
It's not. They're nothing. They should just give them. They're nothing. But they're power hogs. I mean, they. You know.
Oh yeah.
Very.
Yeah.
No, of course.
Very power consuming.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, what about some of the other stuff that, I mean, Cree makes? We had some questions from listeners, too. Alan asked, you know, one of our ham friends was asking about non-LED stuff. So, like, the power devices for GaN and MOSFETs I've seen before. I mean, what's the plan for that kind of stuff? Because I think that's a lot of our listeners are interested in that stuff, too.
Well, we just released a MOSFET recently.
Yeah.
I think it was a 600-volt We've had a Schottky diode out, and I don't work in that area anymore, but I know a little bit about it. So the Schottky diodes are out there. They've been out there for a couple of years, so they're in a lot of power supplies and a lot of solar systems,
solar
inverters. So that's coming along. I think the next set will be the higher voltage versions of everything.
Yeah.
So stay tuned. The power people need to stay tuned.
Okay.
Yeah, I had no idea you guys were working on that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
There
it's,
you
a
go. Big,
it's a reasonable part of our revenue.
Yeah. I saw the N-channel MOSFET, and I know this isn't your area, but I was really excited when I heard about it. I saw the N-channel, and I saw the announced higher voltage stuff, and I got really excited about it. And I don't know. I hope there's like P-channel coming, and just all the different types of FETs you can get. That'd be really cool. But I know that
I'm not sure. I think most of the stuff is N-channel because mobility is so crappy in this holes.
Yeah. Yeah.
In general.
Right. Yeah, it's always harder to get P-channel stuff, right?
But I haven't worked on a P-channel MOSFET here in 20 years, so I have no idea what they're doing.
Come on, John, throw the bunny suit on. Just get back in there and start.
I wear the bunny suit all the time.
Oh, I don't miss that.
I stick with the 2-terminal devices.
That's good. Let's see some of these other listener questions, too. What about DC power for LEDs? I mean, obviously a lot of offline switching happens within the bulb for modules, but I mean, do you see a future where we're maybe with solar panels and using some of those Cree Schottkys, you know, having a solar panel? Actually, I guess the Schottkys are an inverter, so that doesn't really matter, but
right.
But just all DC system, have you seen anything like that or any kind of request for that?
I mean, maybe Edison was right, and DC is going to be the final solution, you know, because you can imagine having solar panels on your house and running DC everything, because AC was for distribution
of power. Distribution. It's not as good for local use.
Fit into the MOSFETs being for low on resistance too, because
exactly.
You don't have those drops. So
exactly, and of course LEDs love DC. I mean, that's how they work. So. You can do your refrigerators, you can do everything else, you can imagine having independent, you know, power systems for your own house.
I don't know about
We're probably at the point where the reliability of these new LED bulbs is dependent upon not the LED itself, but dependent upon the DC to DC converter circuitry and how well you design that.
You are 100% correct. Most failures in those bulbs that you buy are the capacitors.
Uh-huh.
It's everything inside the supply. So they're getting better at it. But if you want a cheap bulb, some of those power supplies are just horrible.
Yeah.
Like those $10 bulbs. You're gonna get probably, you know, one out of every 10 after a few weeks will be burned out. That's the problem.
Right. And that's always heat, right? I mean, I know that's even the problem for CFLs where you have these tiny ballasts inside, you're hanging a CFL upside down, it heats itself up, and then there goes the cap.
They die.
And that gives the whole LED industry a bad rep, doesn't it?
Sure. I mean, if you buy an LED bulb and you put it in and it goes out, you're saying,
the LEDs are no good.
Right.
Yeah. This LED technology is garbage. I don't want that.
No, this electrolytic kettle is garbage, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Are there any government initiatives or anything to try and, you know, stop that sort of thing? I don't know if you can. You know, it's a free market. If you want to buy your $2 replacement LED bulb from China that's designed with the lowest common denominator parts, then...
That's why you're free to do that, right? That's why Cree has a reputation it does, because our bulbs are more expensive, but they don't die.
Right.
They're dimmable. They have true white color. They look like an incandescent, blah, 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 blah. But we have something called Energy Star. If you get an Energy Star emblem on your part, and it's got the lifetime on there as well, and that's part of the Energy Star certification, then you've got a part that's going to work. So you look for the Energy Star logo. Chances are you're going to have a good bulb.
Speaking of LED life expectancies, what is the trade-off between the operating current, you know, like the LED might be rated for operating at 350 milliamps. What's that you know, what is the trade-off between lifetime and heat and temperature, maximum temperature and all that sort of stuff? Can you give us some ballpark?
Sure. I mean, it's
rules of thumb there.
The rule of thumb is you want to have a low thermal resistance to your part. So you want to have it down around 5 to 8 degrees C per watt for the component itself. Then after that, you want to rate it. You want to look at the maximum rating and probably not run it there, but you probably want to run it down near, you know, half of that or something like that in general. And then you have to be able to get the heat taken away. So the heat sinking is critical. And it's not the LED, so it's not the chip. It's the packaging material around the chip that usually has trouble.
Right.
All these are encapsulated in silicones. And
silicones,
not silicon. You wouldn't see anything. Silicones have a very high, you know, transparency for optical transparency, but they also have issues with lifetime. But they're much better than epoxy. So that's really, you're balancing all that. So the best thing you could do is have a high lumen per watt component that you're not creating a lot of heat. I mean, think about it. Mm. If you had 100% efficient, then you're creating zero heat.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's not going to happen. But if you're at 50%, then you got a much better situation than if you're at 10 or 15%.
What's your efficiency at the moment? What's your best efficiency for the best one on the market?
Okay, you're talking about white or blue?
White.
The highest lumens per watt part, I think I had mentioned, was 170 to 175 lumens per watt. Now, if you look at efficiency, that's about complete, including conversion of blue to white, which is you have a loss called Stokes loss. Stokes loss is about 20%. So, but if you take all that, they're about 50% efficient.
Right.
So 50%.
How much do you see that improving in the next couple of years?
I think you'll see over 200 lumens per watt in the next couple of years.
So Stokes loss is that like something you can't get away from, basically, based on the is that just the light absorption of the phosphor?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's it. That's exactly. It's just basically your dominant wavelength of your chip over the emission of your chip, let's say it's a 455. That's what normally the pump is. So 455 divided by your emission of your phosphor, which is roughly 555. So that's roughly 80%, 75%, something like that. Right. So the other part's lost. It's gone.
Huh. So what's the maximum theoretical efficiency that you'll be able to achieve?
I think you can get up the maximum theoretical is, I think it's roughly 230, 250 lumens per watt or something like that.
Right. Okay.
Wow. And there's a law that governs all this stuff. Isn't there like a law, like a Moore's law analog, basically?
There is.
I forget what it's called for LEDs.
Well, but it's basically you can calculate if you have 100% blue pump and you have Stokes loss, then what you're going to get. Now, if you mix red, green, and blue, and if they were all 100% efficient, then you could get lumens per watt over 300, like 350 lumens per watt.
Oh, okay.
Right, because you can get white with red, green, and blue, but now you got to have the right, you know, the right ratios of light, and it's got to be 100% efficient and all that jazz. But that's how billboards are done. I mean, full color displays are all done with RGB.
Yes,
I looked it up. It's called Heitz's law. I was talking about over time.
Heitz's law.
And that's like how this is increasing over time. It's steady increasing over time. Basically,
yeah. They said it would double every. I can't remember what the number is.
I can't find it here. Oh, well. It's getting better. Oh, every 18 to 24
months.
Yeah,
but eventually it comes down to dollars, okay? Then if you get to 200 lumens per watt and you can do it for a penny, well, that's great. If it costs you $10 to do it, it doesn't work. So it's lumens per watt per dollar. That's the key.
That's the one that's going to win regardless of how many lumens per watt it actually is. Yeah. You got to throw in the dollar component.
If it's going to be real, if you want somebody to buy
it. Yeah, that's right.
Hmm. Well, speaking of dollars and China too, I mean, you mentioned China before as they're being held off by the Energy Star standard, but we've talked on this program before about them controlling a lot of the rare earth metals and a lot of the rare elements. Is that affecting you guys in terms of being able to produce LEDs and the more rare chemistries?
Not at all. There's still
not at all.
No,
okay.
No. There's still a lot of rare ones here in the U.S. too, and I wish I knew what all of them were. I think indium. You need indium, gallium, nitrogen, and they're all here. And then some of the other ones for the phosphors. There's some. There's definitely some in the U.S. But that's not. There's enough out there.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, because we usually saw it for like a lot of the electrolytics, like tantalum is a hard one to find, and then the magnet side of things is neodymium.
Oh, that stuff's very rare. That's why they call them rare earths, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so a lot of the process. I always thought indium was in that group of rare elements, but I guess early on they
were saying, oh, there's going to be a shortage of indium because they use it for a lot of electronics. There's plenty of indium out.
Okay. Yeah.
So how many LEDs, do you have any clue how many LEDs you're churning out per year, per month these days?
Billions. It'd be astronomical. I can tell you it's billions. I don't know the exact number.
Billions.
Billions.
Wow. That's crazy.
Billions. Yeah, it's a lot.
That's brilliant. No pun intended.
It's a big number.
And how big of wafers are you guys working on these days? Is it 6-inch, 8-inch, 12-inch?
We have 4 and 6 in production, both 4 and 6.
Okay.
Is there any advantage to go into larger wafers for what you guys
eventually
are doing?
I would say, yeah. We usually make a transition to a larger wafer every, 3 to 4 or 5 years, something like that. So our major production's on 4, and now a lot of it's going to 6. And the next stop will be 8.
Huh. Mm-hmm. So do you guys get a lot of the secondhand gear from like the Intels and the Samsungs of the world?
We definitely look for good prices out there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I was always surprised. I used to work in dry etch, and I was surprised, you could just get new kits. And I mean, if you don't mind old screen, like an old control mechanism for it, it's really not that big a deal. It's still doing the same thing.
Absolutely.
So. Yeah.
How are individual parts actually tested at the manufacturing stage? Are they batch tested, individually tested,
what's
involved?
We test it at the chip level on a wafer. Mm-hmm. Yep. We check it on a wafer.
Right. Okay. So you actually probe it with an automated machine, and how does it test it? Does it test it for just sheer light? Is it a go, no-go light output, or do you actually characterize
it? So it's got its wavelength, its voltage. So it's electrical and basically electrical and optical. And then once we slice the part up and put them in a package, we test those also.
Yep. Right.
Yeah.
How long does it take to individually characterize each one on the actual
milliseconds.
Wafer? At the wafer level. How fast
milliseconds.
Is it? Milliseconds. Yeah. Fantastic.
Fancy.
Yeah, so you can do a lot. And you don't just have to do one at a time.
Okay.
Of course. You can have a multi-probe machine that comes down with multiple sensors for each one, and then multiple drivers. Okay.
And so, on a 6-inch wafer, how many chips or how many die will you get out of a 6-inch wafer on average?
Are you talking about 1-millimeter die, or that's or smaller?
Oh,
die?
Yeah, I guess that matters.
It makes a big difference.
Yeah. I guess how about on your high brightness processes? I mean, like those are probably the biggest die, right?
Yeah. So on a 4-inch. I'm just thinking out loud here. About 8,000 die, 8,000 1-millimeter die on a 4-inch. So it's 2.25 times that. So so it's going to be roughly 17,000 die. Now that's
wow.
But for our smallest die, we're up to about 1 million die per wafer.
Wow!
Oh wow!
Yeah, that was always that was always kind of the.
Okay, you can't probe all of those at once.
Huh?
That's one hell of a bed of nails.
It takes a long time to probe a 6-inch wafer with a
wow.
It's called a UT190, and it's 190 by 190 microns, and it takes like days to probe. Pretty interesting.
It takes days.
Yes.
To get to every LED.
Yeah, it's a million. That's a lot of dye.
Okay, so you actually manufacture one wafer with 1 million on there, and then it takes a day or two to test it.
Yeah.
Wow. How many test machines have you got? I mean, I assume you'd keep churning out the wafers because you don't want to sit there, you'd be stockpiling those wafers. How many test machines would you have going in parallel?
We've got hundreds of
zillions,
hundreds right, of testers, hundreds. Of testers. Right. But anyway, I mean, that was always kind of the futuristic thing to say. Hey, someday we'll have 1 million LEDs on a wafer. Well, we got there.
We're there.
We're there.
Yeah. Next up, a billion.
Yeah.
How important would it be to improve your testing processes to lower in the final cost? I assume that'd be a big component.
Well,
of it. How much would testing cost compared to a raw manufacture kind of
thing? The good thing,
would you
know
that?
The good thing is testing equipment that we've had here is paid for. So, the cost is basically zero, and you put it on there, and it's all automated equipment. Yeah, so you just let it run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's,
and then just uptime at that point.
It's uptime, right? Yeah. So that's a pretty small part of our cost, I can tell you that.
Fab life.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, fantastic.
But anyway, there's a lot of cool stuff.
It sounds like a really exciting time. I'm sure it's been exciting for the entire time you've been there, but just with the uptake of energy efficiency and the lighting, the cost coming down to a point where it's starting to approach that tipping point. I mean, it does sound really exciting.
It is.
There.
I mean, I've been doing this since 1987 when we started Cree, and I'm probably more excited now than I ever have been. But I say that every time I talk to somebody, because I am. That's why I'm still here. I love it.
Yeah.
Are all of the original founders still there?
We have four of the original founders still here.
That's pretty high percentage. That's good.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's
and
fantastic.
Not only that, but three of us live basically within 1,000 or 2,000 feet of each other. So we not only enjoy each other's company at work, we enjoy each other's company all the time. We're like brothers, basically.
That's awesome.
Fantastic.
When you grow up together like that, you become very close.
Yeah. Yeah, you find out a lot about your coworkers when you're there at the lab at 9 o'clock together every night on a Sunday.
You got it.
So you're still a hands-on guy. You're still soldering.
Yep.
Soldering stuff every day.
Not every day, but I was today.
Fantastic.
I couldn't get a damn technician to do it for me fast enough, so I said I'd do it.
And you don't trust any bastard, right? You got a best job is to do it yourself, right?
That's part of it too. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Have you got hobbies outside of Cree, or does Cree consume your life?
No. I love to. We're doing a lot of traveling now, and I play in a band. I've played music all my life. So,
why Chris is will get excited barking? About that.
Sorry. There's a dog at my house.
Is there a wolf or
there's
is it a dog?
No wolf. It's just my dog. Yeah.
Okay, such cool. A professional radio show. Here
I
we
know.
Have
well, she always tells us right when the end of the show. I think we're actually our. We're going to get towards the end.
Our amp hour is up. Our capacity is over. But
that's cool.
Yes.
Well, that's very nice.
Thank you very much,
John.
That was fantastic.
It's so great to hear about LEDs and from a market leader like Cree. That's pretty exciting. So
it's great insight into the company and how it was founded.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's been a great ride.
Well, we look forward to hearing more from you on the LED front, definitely. And
okay.
Great. So
excellent.
People can find Cree on Twitter at Cree, and I think LED Lighting Revolution or something like that. What's the website, John?
Oh, ledrevolution.com?
Any of
that
works.
Yeah, ledrevolution.com, CreeLED, or Cree.com, whatever.
Okay, cool.
And do you have a personal Twitter where you tweet you'd like people to follow you, or you're not into that sort of jazz?
I don't even know what Twitter is. So,
right, okay.
I've had a flip phone until recently.
Right.
But it had a badass LED on it, right?
Right. And kick-ass
somewhere
LED.
Somewhere it did, yeah.
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 All right, John, thanks so much for being on the show. Really, really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Take care, guys.
Thanks.
Hey, bye-bye.